Good afternoon, everybody. Today is February 11th, 2015. We are here at United Orthodox Synagogues of Houston for our class in Parshat HaShavua. This week, we are going to do something a little different. I'm going to attempt to introduce a concept in analyzing different sections of the Torah. We're going to look at a specific instance of it in this week's parsha, and then we'll also look at it in other places and see exactly what this structure is and how it actually helps us focus on the meaning of a particular text. What I'm talking about is something called the chiastic structure. I'm not sure what it's called in Hebrew. It comes from I don't know what language, but chiasmos, I think it's derived from the Greek word chiasmos, which means, it could mean something like crosswise or back and forth. Sometimes it can mean like a loop, because the beginning and the end are connected. And it's a particular construct of text in a particular pattern, which we'll get to, where the goal of this structure is to focus us on what's called the middle or the fulcrum of the structure. So you have two halves of the structure, and then you have one middle piece, and the middle piece is often the key to understanding what the most important part of that section is. We'll see in the example that we're showing that you could actually, if you would write out the text differently in a sequential structure, it would still make sense, but it wouldn't necessarily highlight the importance of the central piece. So in order to get to where we want to go, let's look at one verse in this week's Torah portion, Parshat Mishpatim. We have it here. You don't need the books today. It's on the sheet. Parshat Shemot, Sefer Shemot, the book of Exodus, chapter 23. We have these verses 6 through 9. If you want to look it in the book, you're welcome to. You don't need to. Like I said, it's on the sheet. If you want to look it in the Tanakh, it starts on page 162. Chaf Gimel. Okay. I don't know, for some reason, I was just reminded of one of my Hebrew teachers in high school. His name was Mr. Yerushalmi. And he used to say that studying Torah requires tuchus work. And he says, what is tuchus work? He says, you sit in your tuchus and you work. That's what tuchus work is. So, I don't know, maybe the Hebrew question just jogged that memory.
Believe it or not, but that's a very hard thing to do.
Yes, I know. Especially with a group of high school students. Okay, so Mr. Yerushalmi, he was good. He was a good teacher. Okay, so these are the psukim. Lo tate mishpat evyoncha beribo. You shall not rest the judgment of the poor in his cause. Maybe I'm going to read it. I'm actually going to use the English translation of the book. It's probably a little bit more modern. You shall not subvert the rights of your needy in their disputes. Midvar sheker terchak v'naki v'tzadik al taharo ki lo atzik rasha. Keep far from a false charge. Do not bring death on those who are innocent and in the right, for I will not acquit the wrongdoer. V'shochad lo tikach, ki ashochad yaver p'kichim v'yisalev t'vrei tzadikim. Do not take bribes, for bribes blind the clear-sighted and upset the pleas of those who are in the right. V'ger lo tilchatz, v'atem midatem et nefesh hager ki gerim ha'yitem v'eretz Mitzrayim. You should not oppress the stranger, for you know the feeling of the stranger, having yourselves been strange land of Egypt. I just parenthetically, these psukim, and they're found in many places throughout the Torah, that remind us that we are supposed to not oppress the stranger, are so powerful, because they teach us that our experience as a minority and as an oppressed minority is supposed to make us not less sensitive to other minorities, but more sensitive to other minorities. And it's such, it's so powerful, specifically because we know what it's like. We're not supposed to say, well, we went through it, so they can go through it too. Right? We went through it, so we are supposed to the best as we can, make sure that other people do not go through what we went through. These are some of the most, from my perspective, some of the most moving and powerful psukim in the Torah. But, notwithstanding that, the commentaries have pointed out to a particular difficulty in this set of psukim, which is going to get us to our discussion of the chiastic structure. Okay? Let's look at verse number 7. Verse number 7 has raised the eyebrows of the commentaries. Midvar sheker tirchak. Midvar sheker tirchak. V'nakiv etzadik al tarov. Keep far from false charge. Good. Everyone likes that, right? Do not bring death on those who are innocent and in the right. Meaning, the Torah is very concerned with when it comes to a capital punishment, right? You don't want to kill an innocent person. Right? You don't want to kill an innocent person. So that's why the Torah and the rabbinic literature is extremely hesitant to, let me put it this way, the bar that one has to reach in order to convict someone of a capital crime is almost impossible according to halakha. Right? Because from halakha's perspective, we'd much rather let a guilty person live than wrongly execute an innocent person, right? So this is what it's saying here, right? Do not bring death on those who are innocent and in the right. Now look at this. For I will not acquit the wrongdoer. This verse, this part of the verse seems out of place, right? What does it have to do?
Where is
kilo
it in
Hebrew? Rasha. Meaning don't kill an innocent person. Kilo atzik rasha. Right? What? Again, you should not kill an innocent person because I will not acquit a guilty person.
I'll punish him.
No, it doesn't say I'm going to punish him. I will not acquit a guilty. I will not. No. I will not acquit a guilty person.
That means eventually he'll get his due.
Who's he? He's innocent.
That's not what
don't I'm kill saying. An innocent person because I will not acquit the guilty.
It doesn't say guilty. It says
Rasha. Rasha means in court. You're Rasha. You come out of the... Rasha is a verdict. Rasha is a verdict. Why? Because God... I don't need a reason. What? Do I need a reason not to kill an innocent person? Don't kill an innocent person. Seek. Why don't kill an innocent person... And or because I will not acquit
He'll find the guilty.
But he's innocent.
No. But he's talking about somebody else.
So, but is that the reason? Meaning, is that the reason why we shouldn't kill an innocent person? Because God's going to find the guilty person anyway? No.
No, the person might. You may not be able to prove that he's guilty, so you have to say he's innocent.
Right.
If he really is guilty.
Okay. Good. Okay. Nicely done, man. Let's see Rashi.
Innocent.
Okay. Let's see Rashi. I brought Rashi here for you on the sheets in the shaded section. V'nakiv etzadik al taharog. Right. V'nakiv etzadik al taharog. A person who is innocent. How do we translate it here? V'nakiv etzadik. Do not bring death on those who are innocent and in the right. How do we know? So this is quoting a Gemara, a Midrash, excuse me. How do we know that if one emerges from the court guilty and is given the death sentence, and one of the judges says, I have a way to prove his innocence, meaning there's already been a psak din, there's already been a verdict, and the judge says, hold on, I just thought of something else. We must bring him back to court and retry him, because the Torah says, and do not kill a truly innocent person. Fine. Although he was not declared innocent, for he was not vindicated by the court, he is nevertheless free from the death penalty because you have reason to acquit him. And how do we know that if one emerges from the court innocent and one of the judges says, I have a way to prove his guilt, we do not bring him back to court to retry him? Because the Torah says, and do not kill one who is declared innocent. Okay, fine. And this one is innocent because he was vindicated by the court. So it's actually a double standard, but it works out to the benefit of the accused. If the person is convicted, but there's then later evidence found to exonerate him, then we don't consider that person to be convicted. And we don't consider it to, the psak din to be final. But if the person is found innocent and new evidence comes, which would lead us to retry him and find him guilty, no, in that case, if he's considered to be a psak din, a verdict has been in. So it's we burn the candle on both ends in terms of how we define a psak din. Okay.
Double jeopardy.
But we allow double jeopardy to save the person, but we don't allow double jeopardy to convict the person. Okay, so it's not entirely consistent. Okay, now we come to Marilyn's thing. The next Rashi. Kilo atzdik Rasha. Rashi's obviously bothered by this too. The bottom of the first page. What does this have to do with me not killing an innocent person? So Rashi says, it is not incumbent upon you to return him to court, for I will not vindicate him, turn over the page, in my law. Exactly as Marilyn said. We don't bring the person who was found innocent back to court, even though we have found new evidence which may convict him. Because God says... No, not in that case. Because God says, as Marilyn says, law atzdik Rasha. I'm going to take care of it. Meaning, in the hands of Bidei Adam, in the hands of a person, we're not going to... Again, we're so careful. The hands of the courts of human beings are so careful to avoid killing an innocent person. Once you find them innocent, don't go back and try to retry. But you should also not feel bad that justice wasn't done. Why? Kilo atzdik Rasha. I'm going to take care of it. I'll lie. It's on my shoulders, God says. If he emerges innocent from your hand, I have many agents to put him to death with the death penalty reserved. He'll get hit by a car. He'll have some bad tuna fish. You know, his wife will poison him. Her husband will poison her. Whatever's going to happen, I'll take care of it.
But you know what? Here I'm bothered because later on, or somewhere else, which means, okay, I'll take care of him. He may not be able to take care of him in this generation. I'll take care of the next generation.
That opens up a whole other discussion about lo yum tu avot al banim. Right, we don't punish the children for parents for children. Yeah, I understand that. Let's not go down that road because that's a whole, we could discuss that another time. But generally, the way the Gemara understands that, it says children are only punished for the sins of their fathers if they continue the sins of their fathers. It becomes compounding. But in this case, we're not talking about the children. God's not going to punish the children for this person's sin. Like he said, I have many agents. Some of the agents are drunk drivers. Now I want to be clear that I do not think that every time, I do not think that when someone gets killed in an accident, that it's because they're being punished because they're guilty. Or that when someone gets sick, it's because they're being punished because they're guilty. We are incapable of making such a statement, of knowing how God works. But God, this is the mind of Chazal, the mind of our sages. This is what the Pasuk means to them, exactly as Marilyn said. We shouldn't feel bad that the person was exonerated, even though we know they're guilty. I have many agents, lo atzdik Rasha, I'm going to take care. Okay, that's how Rashi understands it. However, notwithstanding Rashi and Marilyn Karaman, who I know better than Rashi.
I don't understand her either.
There are still a few questions, right? I'm going to read you a few questions from a wonderful book called Between the Lines of the Bible on the Book of Exodus by Yitzchak Et Shalom. He is, I think he lives in Los Angeles. He's a Torah teacher. He's written some wonderful books. So he asks the question that I asked and offers the answer that Marilyn offered in the name of Rashi. So well done. You figured out Rashi's answer by yourself. Yasher koach. Yasher kochachech, I should say. Kochech. Okay. However, Rabbi H. Shalom thinks you and Rashi have still missed the boat. So you're in good company. Either you're right with Rashi or you're wrong with Rashi. Not bad either way. Okay? He asks the following questions. According to Rashi, the end of our verse is not an admonishment. It is a source of consolation, right? Don't feel bad if you exonerated a guilty man or woman. I'll take care of it. That's a nechama, that's a consolation, right? Yes? Everyone with me?
Okay. Not sure.
It doesn't fit in the theme. These are not verses of consolation. They're verses of how are we supposed to carry out judgment. Don't take a bribe. Don't feel bad for the poor person. Right? This is not a section where we're given, we're telling the lawyer or the judge, you know, don't feel bad if you make a mistake. So to suggest what Rashi suggests, it works on one level, but in terms of the context of what else is going on in these verses, it does not seem to work. That's question number one that he asks. Question number two is, how does the opening clause of distance yourself from false matter connect with the rest of this verse as read by Rashi? Right? I understand the second, there are three parts of this verse. Let's look at the verse again. Don't take a bribe. I'm sorry, where are we? Yeah, don't lie. Distance yourself from false matter, one, A. Don't kill an innocent person, and I will not exonerate the guilty. I understand how part B and C, according to Rashi and Marilyn, fit together. But where does part A come in?
Based on the testimony of false witnesses.
Which section?
The line Kiyoaz Dikrasha.
At the end of what?
At the end of the those three verses.
Right.
It refers to us as, you know, taking care of the law.
Ah, very nice. Okay, hold on. You're way ahead of me. Hold on one second. What's your name?
Chana.
Excellent. Hold on one second. A few seconds. So that's Rashi's second question. Is what does the admonishment against taking the bribe have to do with the third? We've already solved how B connects to C, but how does A have anything to do with C? And finally, well, that's all we're going to do. Okay. So in order to answer this question, Rabbi H. Shalom introduces this chiastic structure. Chiastic structure is, we'll give you a couple of examples. It's best if we look at examples. Let's look at the paper that I handed out, where it says Book of Esther. Now, chiastic structure, as I explained at the outset, is a structure in, it could be in any text, not only a Bible text, where there are sort of two parallel parts at the edges and sort of a central or fulcrum, central idea in the middle. This could apply to one verse. It could apply to a group of verses. It could even apply, according to some scholars, to entire books of the Bible. They say it could be written with the first four chapters referring to one thing, the one middle chapter being the fulcrum, and the last four chapters sort of being the reverse or mirror image of the first four. Okay? Let's look at an example of this in the Book of Esther. The Book of Esther here, you see A, B, C, D, C, B, A. Right, so you have the king's glory is A, B, Esther comes to the king, C, Mordechai overhears the plot, which is the glory of Mordechai, D, Mordechai refuses to bow down to Haman, and then the Chozer HaDavar. Now we go, thing starts again, but now backwards. Mordechai overhears the plot of the Jews this time, to kill the Jews. Esther comes to the king, as she did in B above. And A, the glory of Mordechai, which is the king's glory. What's the center of these chapters of Megillat Esther? What is this structure supposed to focus us on? That the key to the whole book is Mordechai refusing to bow down to Haman. That's a classic chiastic structure.
How come it's not called Megillat Mordechai?
Good one.
Good question. Fair question. Let's look at this example in the book of Bereshit. The entire book of Bereshit. Well, not the entire book, but the first three chapters. The creation of Adam, the creation of Chava, the serpent, eating from the forbidden tree, then the punishment of the serpent, the punishment of Chava, the punishment of Adam. So you have Adam, Eve, serpent, serpent, Eve, Adam, and the middle, which doesn't seem to fit in, is eating from the forbidden tree and its results, again, focusing us on that as the central, most important idea of those chapters. So here we see this structure is used to explain even a whole book of Esther or a chunk of a book. How does it work in terms of one pasuk? So let's look in Shemot chapter 15. Let's go to chapter 15, verse 14. This is Az Yashir, the song of the sea that the Jews sang when they came through the sea. I want to show it to you. You can see it in Hebrew. I have the English. Okay, Shirat Hayam, page 144. And all, the chiastic structure is often A-B-B-A. Now, sometimes between the first A and B and the second B and A, there's something in the middle, but not in this case. So, right, what do you have here? Shamu Amim Yirgazun.
Which?
14, Yud-Dalet. 144, 14. So it's Perek Tetvav, Pasuk Yud-Dalet, page 144, chapter 15, verse 14. I think I got all the languages covered. Shamu Amim Yirgazun. Nations will hear and be afraid. Chil Achaz Yoshvei Pelashet. Trembling will take hold of the inhabitants of Philistia. Look now on the paper that I handed out, and you see the structure. A, nations will be afraid. Trembling will take hold. Those are B's. And back to A, the inhabitants of Philistia, again referring to another nation. Right, you could write this verse sequentially. How would you write this verse sequentially? Not in this type of poetic form. You would have written, nations will hear and be afraid. The inhabitants of Philistia would tremble when they hear. Right? You could rearrange these verses to write them sequentially. But here the Torah chooses to have them in this chiastic structure, maybe to focus us in on the trembling and the fear that this event has created. So putting the two phrases of trembling and fear next to each other sort of saturates the pasuk and highlights that what's going on here is that the splitting of the sea really instilled fear in people. We may have gotten the same message with a sequential writing of the verse, but this poetic methodology forces us to focus in on what's going on. So here the structure, as you see, is A, B, B, A. So as I said, often in this type of structure, you have A, B, B, A, but sometimes, like we saw in Esther, you have A, B, and then you have something in the middle, like Mordecai not bowing down, or the serpent, right? Sometimes you have something else in the middle. So let's now, with that understanding, let's look at our verse and see if we can understand it a little bit differently than Rashi understood it. Right? We could find, according to Rabbi Et Shalom here, he found a chiastic structure in these verses. Okay? He starts out by reminding us that when someone is a judge, there are certain dangers inherent in that power. Right? One is that there's going to be too much concern for the letter of the law and not any emotion or human
empathy.
That's one concern. There's a zeal for justice, and that zeal for justice may block out the human element involved in whatever crime or whatever event the judge is looking at. On the other hand, there's also the possibility that the judge, seeing a stranger, someone who's different, right, is going to see the stranger as a threat to the given society. So now look at the psukim. Thou shalt not. Let's go back to the English translation that we have in the in our Tanakh, because it's better. Chapter 23, verse 6. Page 162. Thou shalt not subvert the rights of your needy in their disputes. That seems to be a warning that the judge should not forget that the poor man is your man. Right? Evyoncha. Doesn't just say Evyon. It's interesting. It's not just an objective person. It's your, this is a member of your community. This is your poor person. Right? Do not subvert the rights of your... The rich person is more powerful, whatever the case may be. Do not overlook the poor person. Even though by the letter of the law, it may be something, but we have to recognize that there are other things at play here, right? The judge must not forget that the poor man is your poor man, your responsibility, and your brother. That's A. Now there's another A at the end. Right? Pasuk 9. V'ger lo tilchatz. Don't oppress the strangers. Of course, the person's a stranger. Don't think that they don't deserve the same justice that everyone else does. Don't treat them as a threat. So the two A's are warnings that the judge has to be careful about what they're going to do. Now, what are the B's? The problem is, if you're too sensitive to these things, you also run the risk of not being just. If you're too sensitive to the poor person, you're also going to end up not judging carefully. That's where B, keep thee from a false matter, and the innocent and the righteous slay thou not. Just because a person's poor doesn't mean you...
He's innocent.
That's right, and that's not a reason to exonerate them, right? I'll tell you how he says it. The B phrases serve as a counterbalance to the compassion mentioned above. The judge, apprised of the demands of compassion placed upon him, might pervert justice due to that self-same compassion. The poor man is so much needier, he thinks the compassionate judge. The rich can afford to lose. The poor man is probably innocent. I must show him mercy. So the two A's are reminding us of the problems of only looking at strict justice and being afraid of the stranger. And then the B is, hold on a second. It's one thing to let emotion into this, but just because the person's poor and the rich person can afford to lose whatever he would lose, don't end up in a situation where you're lying. And what's the second B? Thou shalt not take graft. Now, often graft is understood as a bribe. But according to Chazal, it's not a bribe. It's an internal bribe. I feel like, even though I know that A is innocent and B is guilty, but something, I'm feeling bad for B because he's poor, or he grew up in a broken home, or it was situations beyond control. We're not worried about someone bribing the judge. We're worried about the judge bribing himself because of his compassion.
Where does it say himself?
Because the Gemara says that there are other places that the Torah talks about bribes, and here in the context of what we're talking about, there's nothing external, because also in the context it's also internal. Okay, so now, then the question is, what is C? Right, where does this non sequitur, for I will not justify the wicked? For I will not justify the wicked come in, right? Where does that come in? Why is that C? So Rabbi Eitz Shalom here says something amazing. Because we have to remember, right, that a judge on some level may feel that they are actually taking God's place, right? Because ultimately, who's the judge? Ultimately, the judge of the world is God. But God has handed us the right or the responsibility to judge criminal and all other cases in this world. So the judge playing God, right, might come to the conclusion that he can do whatever he wants.
Actually, what he's looking
at... Hold on one second. The judge, maybe the judge could do whatever he wants, and any verdict that I'm going to come up with is going to be okay. So what does God say? For I will not justify the wicked. That's what you said. Who's the wicked?
We are.
With the judge.
Yeah,
The judge. Not this is not. This is not saying like Rashi says. Don't worry if there's someone who's innocent, but you find them guilty, I'll take care of the litigant. This is not the litigant. Why? None of these psukim are talking about the litigant. All of these psukim are talking about the judge. To all of a sudden switch from talking about the judge to talking about the litigant is inconsistent. So it's all the litigant. And
if we do all the things that he tells us not to do, then we will be considered the Rasha.
Exactly, right, exactly. And that's the middle, that's the C. It's out of place on purpose to call our attention to it, to say, what is going on here? What's going on here is God is giving us warnings about how to carry out justice, and also the warning that just because we are given the right to judge people doesn't mean that everything we do is automatically right and we could do whatever we want. Ki lo atzdik rasha. If you are a evil judge, like Rashi, then Rashi's right. I have my ways. I will get you, the judge, not the litigant. So if you look at these verses in the chiastic structure with C as the out-of-place element, it's not out-of-place at all. All the other psukim are focusing us in on those things. Like exactly as Chana said, if we do all the things here that we're told not to do, then C is activated. Mm-hmm. That's how Rabbi Et Shalom suggests we learn these psukim, because of the difficulties of the way Rashi has them. And again, the question essentially of all of these admonitions, first of all, it's not nechama. These are not statements of comfort, while we seem to have a statement of comfort according to Rashi. And also, every single one of these rules is directed towards the judge. So this we also have to find a way to read this verse where it's also directed towards the judge, and that's how he suggests that we do it. So I thought this was a fantastic introduction into this whole notion of chiastic structures. You could do a Google search on them in Hebrew or in English, and you'll find they're all over the place in the Tanakh, and they really give us a fantastic insight, not only in how to read one pasuk or a cluster of psukim, but also how to read entire books of the Torah. And sometimes some are suggesting that the chiastic structure actually bridges between one book of the Torah and another book of the Torah. Toda rabba, everybody. That's it for the day.